This episode of the CMO Suite is brought to you by Uconex. Uconex is the premier provider of managed and in-house servicing in the biddable media space. If you're looking for true transparency with paid social, PPC, or programmatic, or are a brand or agency looking into in-housing your team, connect with Uconex. Uconex.com and Tumi. Tumi provides luxury without limits. I've got the bag. I've got the backpack. Thank you, Charlie Cole. If you are a business traveler, there is nothing that lets you roll in style like Tumi. It's in the studio with me today. That's true. And finally, No Kid Hungry. We are incredibly proud to make a contribution to No Kid Hungry in the name of each of our 2019 guests. Stop by NoKidHungry.org today to contribute and help kids to be kids, not be hungry. Let's start the show.
You're in the CMO Suite, the podcast for marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
Hello and welcome to the CMO Suite. I'm your host, Sean Halter. This is it, guys. This is our last episode of season two. I am incredibly excited about our guest who has agreed to join us on the show. He's done some of his own research. I see he brings notes too, so that's usually a good sign. It is Michael Loeb. Michael is a serial entrepreneur. He's currently the president and CEO of Loeb New York City, which is a private venture investor, startup incubator, and operator of consumer marketing businesses. There's much more to talk about here. There's much more accolades, but I was incredibly excited to see him speak several times, and I am beyond elated that he agreed to be part of the show. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's Michael Loeb. Michael, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Sean.
You are
nice to be here.
You've got the voice for radio, and you do a
lot.
I do. Of content,
I got a face for radio.
Don't we all? And Mike, listen, my age is 49, and I always have to work in the fact that my club age is 39.
Right.
In the show. So, do you have a club age, Michael? Let's just
it's 11.
It. 11.
I want to start young.
Too young to even get in the club. Well, listen, thank you for joining us. As I said on the show, I've seen you speak several times. Mm-hmm. The last time I saw you, I think you were speaking at Brand Week, maybe here in New York City. It was an Ad Week event. And I think that was either the second or the third time I've seen you speak. And I always find it fascinating to have somebody like you at those events, because they are typically a lot of chief marketing officers or a lot of people in the marketing industry are there, but you always bring a different perspective to the marketing game. Although you are not a CMO, clearly, you often, when you are having those conversations, I feel like you do a pretty amazing job of being relatable to the space.
Well, thank you very much. The first observation you had is that I had a face for radio.
Listen, you said it, and I'm saying that I know I have a face for radio.
Yeah.
Stacey?
But you should know that this is kind of, genetically connected, because my dad did a lot of radio.
He did do a lot of radio. I'm going to talk about that. And so did he start in the industry to some extent?
No, he started. He was a newspaper and magazine guy.
Okay.
Right? He was his last job at Time Inc. He worked at Time Inc. for close to 40 years. I followed him on the marketing side. He was a journalist, and his last job was the managing editor of Fortune magazine.
Oh, and he did a radio show there.
He did, well, even before that, he had Marshall Loeb's Your Money Minute was his thing. CBS Radio syndicated in a zillion different markets around the country, and he did that for about a million years, yeah.
And so how old were you when he was doing that show?
Oh, God. He probably started when I was in my teens.
Did you ever go when he was producing the show?
I did, actually. I did, and he also did a lot of TV. Remember Merv Griffith?
Of course.
He had a week-long gig in Merv Griffith, and that was in Philadelphia, and I was on, in studio, and it's a live thing. And it was, he was America's financial advisor, right? So before Fortune was Money Magazine, and then at Time, he built the economics advisors at Time Magazine. He did a lot of stuff, but he was from Money Magazine, and he really put it on the map at the time. God bless it. But anyway,
how was that growing up and kind of seeing somebody who's clearly an extrovert?
Right, right. He was, yes.
How did that shape your life?
Well, obviously, I just climbed into a hole and never got out.
you definitely followed in his footsteps.
Right. Well, not really. I mean, he was, again, the journalist. And I said, this journalism thing, it's great to write about people who have made a whole lot of money, but it's even better if you can make the whole lot of money. Yes. Yeah, so when it came to fame, that went left and I went right. I went to, let's try to make some money. But it was, I grew up in Queens.
Yeah.
Journalists don't tend to make a lot of money. You're the exception.
That's true,
right?
Listen,
anyway,
this is not my day job.
It's not your day job.
That's clearly the case. Somebody did ask me the other day, how do you monetize the podcast? I was like, I don't need to make money from the podcast.
Right.
You do the podcast because you want to meet interesting people.
People, right? Oh, and I'm supposed to be an interesting person.
We're ending the season with you. That should tell you something.
You know, but it does. Bottom of the barrel,
not
right?
True.
I mean, all the interesting people came first.
That's true. Then it was me. Save the best for
Thank
last.
You for that, Stacey, but I don't believe you. You're not great. But anyway, so what was cool is if you grew up in that environment, which was, you know, an environment of letters and kind of intellectualism and all the stuff that Bill de Blasio doesn't like anymore. Anyway, but, you know, you'd learn a lot and you'd see a lot. And so from that standpoint, it was very rich. It was not rich in the traditional sense. It was a big day when I was 8, when we went from a 2-bedroom apartment to a 3-bedroom apartment, which meant that I no longer had to share my bedroom with my sister.
With your sister.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So we had our own bedroom. Well, still only one bath, but okay. I had my own bedroom.
We came from some similar cloth to some extent, though. I mean, mm-hmm. we were poor growing up. And I don't mind saying it because my kids clearly have no understanding of
what that means
of any of that now, which is probably a good thing to some extent. You know, you always want to try to give back to your kids, and we'll talk about yours in just a second. You've got a pretty amazing family that you've built. But I had to share a room with my stepsister. My mom would take us out to eat literally twice a year. And my school clothes and my birthday money were all combined because my birthday was near the start of school.
Right.
And so I feel like to some extent when you come from that, maybe it's the grounding that we all really need to some extent to know what life is really like out there.
Right. Well, if the progressive have their way, we're all going to be back to that. So
this is not a political show, Michael.
Not yet.
Yes, not yet. Listen, you once named 4 people who inspire you, including Steve Jobs, Thomas Edison, Tom Brady, and your dad was one of those, Marshall Loeb.
Mm-hmm. So Federer. And you for the same reason.
So you remember
I do. For the same reason, which is, you know, both Federer and Brady are in the top of their game, and they should have aged out like 5 years ago. But somehow, you know, the mental acuity, and if you look at how they change their game, you know, over time in order to accommodate kind of, you know, the new state of play is really pretty amazing. So I, as an old guy myself, I just admire that stuff.
And so how do you equate some of that, even just that part of it back to marketing? Do you equate it in the fact that sometimes it doesn't matter how old you are in this industry, that sometimes that age is actually a huge asset, because 20-year-olds may know everything there is to know about what's happening on Facebook and Instagram, actually more Instagram than anything else. They may know what's going on with Pinterest, but they don't have years. They don't have the understanding of this is how money works.
Right.
And one of my guests on a previous episode, Jackson Gianigam, was talking about the fact that how he felt like he really needed to round out his career as a CMO was to become
old.
But to be able to understand the money part of it and to take himself out of the game of always having to come with a handout and saying, well, this is what I think we should spend money on, and get into the financials. And so do you concur with that to some extent?
To a lot of extent. I mean, I think that just like the movie and the book Moneyball, right, where it was not just, you know, kind of old school gut, and it was not just data, but it was the amalgam of the two. I think that if the new generation will allow themselves to learn from the people who came before them and vice versa, that actually is the winning combination. So one of the great treats I have in doing what I do is I meet people, and I mean this in all humility, smarter than me all the time. And it's just amazing to me to sit down and, you know, a few years ago, I didn't know what an algorithm was, right? I mean, hear and see what they're building and how fast. And I think, you know, many of the tenants are just the same. Like I hear about Google, for example, is direct mail.
You've heard of them.
I've heard of them.
Yeah.
But in super fast motion, right? I mean, it's just real time direct mail, right? Instead of once every 6 weeks, it's once every 6 seconds. But it's the same idea. I mean, it's about targeting and lists and offer and presenting the story and blah, blah, blah. So if you can keep your mind open, you can actually take some of the old lessons and make them into new lessons, but not directly, right? You got to translate them into this new language. But I think that both, you know, kind of the 26-year-old newbies and us oldbies, when we get around the room and we actually listen to one another, you actually find a pretty good outcome.
So you can coexist. Your point with direct mail is a funny one, because mm-hmm. we use that actually in many cases when we're talking to a client sometimes, right. and you're trying to help them to understand what behavioral targeting or contextual targeting is, or how do you get all these names of all these people? And so mm-hmm. we'll use that as an analogy. It's mm-hmm. it's the direct mail business yeah. just brought forward into yeah. a digital
writ
space.
Large, writ large and immediate. I mean, we never had in direct mail, you never had a list that was 2 billion big, yeah. which is what you have in Facebook and Instagram and Google. I mean, it's unbelievable, and it's instant, and you get all the responses right away, and you can A, B, C, D, E, F, G split and get that, you know, real time, and it's, you know, it's read and react, except the iteration cycles are skinnied up into nanoseconds instead of months.
You talked about the fact that your dad was in kind of this side of the business, and mm-hmm. when the lane came, you picked this lane.
Mm-hmm.
You picked
mm-hmm.
the lane that where there's maybe more of a financial opportunity than perhaps the other. Why do you feel like you picked
Well,
that?
I think it picked me. I kind of had that head that I could always do math in my head, and I kind of would look at something and figure out the business model. I think that we haven't talked about entrepreneuring yet, but when we do, I do believe there's an entrepreneur's gene. Okay, and part of that gene is you look at anything and you kind of say, I can do that better.
Well, let's jump into it. You feel like that was the space where you found comfort was in. Was it a control thing to some extent, becoming an entrepreneur? What do you think is the gestation for somebody becoming an entrepreneur?
I do think it's genetic. I really do. I do think there's a dimension of it. That's the kid with the lemonade stand. That's the kid who's with the newspaper route. That's the kid who's cutting all the lawns in the neighborhood. That's the kid when they run out of actual lemons, they kind of make grass aid.
We
right?
used to call and that like, hustle. I don't think you're allowed to call that anymore.
Well, you know, okay, call it hustle,
but
it's an imagination thing, right? And it's the combination of the two, right? The hustle and also the empowerment or feeling like you can do this, right? And I'd say of entrepreneurs that they think physical laws, like gravity, is for everybody else. A stop sign, that's an opportunity for you to go faster because every other idiot is like stopping, but not you. Right? You can go right through it because all the other guys are stopping.
Opportunity.
It really is. And you kind of tend to look at everything and you kind of just want to turn over that rock and say, I will find riches. And there's some truth to that. It's really about the road less traveled or untraveled at all. And I do have, Sean, a talk that I give in colleges. And I'm invited invariably by the Entrepreneurs Club. So I know my audience. So I say, who here wants to be an entrepreneur? Raise their
Everybody
hand.
Raises
Everybody.
Their hand. Yep.
Who here is going to quit school? Nobody raises their hand. And then I go to slides, which is unusual in a speech. And I go, Steve Jobs, right? Quit in a sophomore year. Gates, sophomore year. Dell, sophomore year. Just like all the rock and rollers died when they were 27, all the entrepreneurs quit in their sophomore year. Now, why is that? Well, it's a little bit about what Buffett said. Which is
Not Jimmy, Warren.
Warren, yeah. Not Jimmy. But Jimmy is doing unbelievable. He's killing it, right?
We work with them.
They're amazing. God, that's just, you do, don't you? Right. I mean, what he's doing with Margaritaville is crazy. So.
But Warren said.
Warren said, thank you for that. Warren said, if the path to riches can be found in books, then every librarian would be a billionaire. Well, you know, and that's the problem with colleges and entrepreneurs, because they look at these guys with the pipes and, you know, the kind of elbows coming out of the sleeves, and they say, you know what, this is backward looking, right? This historical reference stuff does not speak to me because I'm inventing a future that is brand new. And, you know, you could read as much as you want about Einstein or Leonardo da Vinci, but the iPad, you can't find that there, right? And so that didn't speak to a Jobs or a Gates or a Michael Dell or whatever. And these guys, they get started early, like Michael Dell was, you know, kind of like tricking up computers and selling them when he was like a freshman in college. And I do think, and that's not everybody. I mean, most people say, well, let's go ahead and get, you know, let's get 3.2 beer and get drunk, but not Michael Dell. He's in his dorm room figuring out how to make a, you know, triple the clock speed in a computer.
He won't conform.
But to your point, you said something interesting there. You talked about the
one
fact
thing,
that,
just one thing interesting.
No, lots of interesting things.
Okay, fine.
But one thing I was a little insulted, I pulled out of it, which was the fact that you said something to the extent of that entrepreneurial spirit allows you to kind of look differently at things and maybe pull something that's new out of it, or it has a new perspective to some extent. I'm surmising that. Mm-hmm. But from a marketer standpoint, I think the same thing can be said. You don't even have to be an entrepreneur to look, and no matter what your age is, to look and see what's happening out in the space and decide, I'm ready to do something different. I'm ready to be a nonconformist. And so I think when you look at it that way, you don't have to be 20. You don't have to be 22. Do you feel like you do? Do you feel like you have
to
start
No, I don't
that?
Think you have to be. But you, I will tell you that, you know, if you look at digital, you know, I did not grow up with that, right? I mean, they barely invented copiers when I got into the workforce. Somehow, you know, for the millennials and the post-millennial generation, this is something that I grew up in. I mean, they grew up playing video games and they just get it. And I get stuck and I have to ask one of my kids, you know, where do I find that? And they say, well, everybody knows where you find that. It's right over there. They all work that way. And, you know, it's like not intuitive to me. I mean, I didn't know that. Back to your question about CMOs, I think you got to take an Edisonian view. And Edison said, I never failed. I just figured out 10,000 ways how not to make a light bulb. And I think you, as a CMO, you got to approach media like that, which is you got to you know, test and fail fast, not spend a lot of money on that. You got to go in with a hunch, but you let the data prove you right or wrong, which is hard, by the way.
And the data allows you to at least do that now, whereas you didn't really have the chance to do that.
You would, but the iteration cycles were months, not minutes or seconds or nanoseconds. I mean, it's just amazing.
What was the tipping point for you? What was the point of in your life where things tipped from, hey, I'm going to be an entrepreneur to... this is really happening, and it's happening at a rapid pace. Was that Priceline, or was it something prior
well,
to that?
Well, here's what happened. I followed my dad into Time, Inc., and followed in the business side.
And did you get fired?
And I got fired.
That's awesome.
I got fired.
That's such a crazy story.
It is. And, well, I think it is. And I was a little bit of the enfant terrible, right? And, you know, I didn't care, right?
Was it because you were his son?
No, it was because I was wired differently. And basically, Time, Inc. at the time, again, Time, Inc., God bless its soul, like the detritus, the bones are being buried right now. It's really too bad. But Time, Inc. was a collegial place. It was the place of Britton Haddon and Hank Luce and a couple of Yaleys who really wanted to save the world. And Hank Luce was the son of the prodigy of missionary parents. He grew up in China. And he didn't care about making money. He just wanted this journalism thing. He wanted to evangelize for the world. And by the way, he damn near got us into war against China because he was supporting Taiwan at the time. But, So it really wasn't about making money. The money was all kind of secondary. But for me, that was like the only thing. And I was beating to a different drummer. I just wanted to make the most money I could. I will tell you a story that I was brought into... the publisher's office, the publisher saw me to give me my bonus check. And my bonus check, and I was all of like 27, was $100,000, right? We got to go down to the Pleistocene to figure out how much money that was. And he's handing me this $100,000 check. And by the way, it was all math, right? It was just what was EBITDA, what was performance, blah, blah, blah. So it was a performance-based check. Here I am, 27. There are people 47 and 57 not getting anywhere near that. And it's a $100,000 check. And the publisher at the time, I won't mention his name, big affable guy, you know, ex-football player. And we were allowed to smoke in the office. The guy always had a cigar, generally unlit, you know, and he would be waving around a cigar all the time. And he said to me, Michael, I'm giving you this check, but I want you to know it's not all about making money. And I opened the envelope, looked at the check, and I said, Don, waving the check back at him, maybe it's not all about making money. It's 99% about making money. And he slumped, put his head in his hands, and he said, get the hell out of my office. So that was, you know, what I was all about was it was, you know, in a world of 4, 5, and 6% was okay because the thought, it's kind of like when you go to a family office that manages money, their thing is learn to love 6% gains. Right. And that's because they're all about safety first. And when you have a franchise that included Time Magazine and Sports Illustrated and People Magazine and Money Magazine and Fortune and the rest of that portfolio, it was don't screw it up. just don't screw it up,
yeah.
right? And the business types, just don't screw it up. You are the custodians. It's all about the editors. It's all about the writers. Just don't screw it up, right? And that's kind of what it was about. I'll tell you a story that my dad would wear as a badge of honor, but there was an advertiser, big advertiser, I won't mention the name. And
but you could.
I could. And he was editing Fortune
magazine.
If this
was vodka rather than Poland Springs, could we?
Maybe.
There's a chance, okay.
But big advertiser, and it was private, one of the largest privately held companies. And he found out, because nobody really knew, and the brothers had built this giant company, and nobody really knew about their parents who died under very mysterious circumstances.
Okay.
And it turned out that it was a murder-suicide. And my dad found that out first, right? And back in the day when they actually would check facts, they were checking that fact. And then the call came, and it was, if you run that story, we are taking $100 million of advertising a year and all Time Warner, and it goes up
away.
In smoke,
yeah.
right? Goes away. And he said, that was all I have to hear. I'm running the damn story, because that was,
journalism back
the authentic
day.
Part of journalism, right? And that's what it was all about. And it was, he didn't do it out of spite. What it really was that what,
principle.
And in fact, if you really thought about it, it really added not only color, but it added, you know, gravitas to their story. They were able to cope with that and build this, you know, giant, unbelievably successful company, and more power to them for having to deal with, cope with that and still build this incredible franchise.
I can't imagine the poor account executive who was responsible for,
yeah.
that, for that account to some extent. Let's dovetail off that, if you don't mind, for
sure.
just a second, which is, again, money obviously is an important part of life. It's
yeah.
an important part of building a brand,
yeah.
building a business. You have companies right now like Kraft Heinz that are kind of getting a little bit skewered with mm-hmm. how they manage their financing when it comes to marketing and advertising, and whether they've damaged brands by ensuring that all expenditures, you know, make sense and that they all kind of revert back to revenue. Do you get to a point, either from a personal standpoint or even from a marketing standpoint, you get there and the money's there, but it also doesn't bring you happiness to some extent? Does that ever come into a play, or should it come into play, or is it just that's just a woven part
oh,
into?
Of course, it comes into play, but you know, they do say that after a time, money is a way of keeping score, and I do think that's really what it does. I'm still in the game, and you know, the fact of the matter is, after I sold Synapse to Time Warner, and we haven't talked about that.
We haven't. You have time.
Listeners are going to like that. But after I sold that, I said to my wife, I never have to be smart one more day in my entire life. I don't need one more good idea. I don't need anything. I could actually grow tomatoes. Today it would be cannabis, but I could grow tomatoes.
That's true.
The fact of the matter is,
you settled, that's not settled the score, but you settled the score to some extent because it came full circle.
Right. It did.
And they paid you.
They did pay me.
And they paid you well.
They paid me very well. My wife does call me the most expensive rehire in Time Warner history.
That's very funny.
But it all
worked out.
It all worked out.
I want to make sure we have some time with you.
Sure.
We have you for about another half an hour, so thank you
okay.
for your time. We've talked about your dad a little
mm-hmm.
bit. We've talked
mm-hmm.
about some of your historical. Talk about your mom to some extent. So how did she impact
she was a toughie.
Who you became?
She was a toughie. My mom, so I'm half Jewish, half Catholic, which means I can do
which
that.
Half?
Well, my dad's Jewish.
Okay.
And my mom was Catholic. And it means I can do computational math, but I can also play lacrosse, right? And
I don't know how those relate.
And I can
maybe Stacy does.
I can bench press like a sick
like nobody's
amount of
business.
Right, I
yeah.
really can't. So, you know, that's it's a good combination. So my parents were both rebels. My dad came from a, you know, poor, legitimately poor Jewish family. And I know, oxymoron, right? Anyway, back then they had those. But my grandfather came off the boat from Germany and built an enormous business in wrecking and salvage. And he was married four times but had only one child from all those marriages, which was my grandfather. And my grandfather wrecked the wrecking business. So it was a Jewish version of Sanford and Son. So instead of Sadie, or instead of Elizabeth, it's Sadie, I'm coming to get you. Anyway, So my dad, who was also an only child, was supposed to take over the business. And in a fit of rebellion, he went to the University of Missouri. He didn't know if he wanted to become a mathematician or a journalist. So I got that little that math thing going on. And decided to become a journalist. Lived in a chicken coop for $2 a year.
Wow.
Right? Because that's what he could afford. And then got a job with United Press International after he graduated college. In part because he wanted, and he went to Germany, right? Went to Germany because he wanted to understand how could, you know, this country, which had the most assimilated Jewish population, turn on those people. There were, you know, hundreds of Jewish war heroes from World War I, thousands, probably generals. And how could, you know, how could that happen? And he wanted to figure that out. And while he was there, he met this perky Pan Am stewardess. We called him that back then.
Back in the day, you were allowed to, yes.
That's right. And if you weren't a movie starlet, you became a Pan Am stewardess. That was just the
roles.
That was
the gig.
That was her gig. And she's she was German, but perfect English and redheaded and blah, 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 and really very pretty. All my kids look like her, which is great. And, yeah, they got married, and she was the product of a very tough upbringing, even though it was wealthy, but she lived through World War II and damn near starved, and her real father died when she was about 2 years old. Her mother got remarried to a Russian of some noble heritage, running away from the Romanovs, and so she was sent to Czechoslovakia to grow up as a nun, and... became a Pan Am stewardess. Go figure.
Wow.
But yeah, so she had some anger issues. Okay, but anyway, they got married and had two of us, my sister and I. I'm older, and she is. My mom would always say, "Michael, you've got the brains, and your sister's got the looks." And thank God, it's not the other way around. But okay, she went off road, became a McKinsey consultant. Before that, she won a journalism prize when she was actually in college and quit college. And she was probably the only McKinsey consultant to never graduate college. And now she is has her own practice with McKinsey being one of her biggest clients.
That's great.
She's doing, when I say practice, business.
Yeah.
So she's in business too.
So they both shaped you to some extent.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so, listen, we talked about this when we first started the podcast. You're one of the guests that we have this season that has a lot of content out there. That doesn't always happen. Mm-hmm. A lot of our guests, they don't speak a lot, but you speak a lot. And so there's a lot of really great podcasts and other things that you've done with some great content. Certainly some of those go into even more depth on how you end up with Synapse and Priceline. Mm-hmm. And so let's tell a slightly truncated version of that, because you've told it so many times. But how did the Priceline piece kind of come about? You had a partner at the time. Mm-hmm. And so talk about that to some extent.
Sure.
And then Synapse.
So you're right. I was fired from Time Inc.
That was a funny story that I heard.
Yeah. And I was got the reputation at Time Inc. as launch boy, right? At some time I would have been launch man, but I was launch boy and had something to do with the launch of Sports Illustrated for Kids, was the CMO of Sports Illustrated. God bless its soul. And was asked to take a look at a project in the business that didn't have a sponsor, and that was Entertainment Weekly. And I thought of it as kind of a direct translation from sports to entertainment. So Big Three Sports substitute Big Three Entertainment. I talked about how editorial, and they called it church and state, but editorial had a sanctimonious type of approach. And the editor at the time, even though the last name was Weekly, thought that he could write a lot about poetry and books and get to the required circulation. And in a weekly title, it's got to be 1 million or there's no hope of making any money. You got to have that scale. So we're both shown the door. And what I try to do, Sean, when I was shown the door, and it was a loud, you know, it was a loud firing, and basically the position of Time Inc. was nothing's wrong, whoops, something was wrong, but we cut the tumor out of the body and cast it out, so now everything is okay again with Entertainment Weekly. So the likelihood of me being rehired in media was not high. You know, I was irradiated, had to wait for the half-life. That would have been about 3 years. they paid me very well to not sue them. Okay. And instead of pocketing the money, I bought a townhouse, right? Dumb me. Anyway.
It's not a bad investment.
Yeah, worked out well.
There you go.
We still have it. It's on the west side. You should check it out.
Thanks.
Anyway, so, and I really tried to start, I really did start the business outside of Time Inc. that I was trying to start inside of Time Inc., which was very simply at the time, it was one subscription at a time. And now if you connected that to a credit card, it could keep on going. So essentially you took inertia, which was your mortal enemy back in the day when we would mail out renewal notices and bills. And you took inertia as your mortal enemy and made it your best friend. And so all of a sudden did nothing and the subscription
keeps going
as opposed to it automatically stops was the thing. I get cursed by just about everybody for that system. They're saying, oh my God, I still subscribe to 1400 magazines and it's your fault. Anyway. But it was transformative for the magazine industry. And when you think about it, it always should have been that. It shouldn't have been like peanut butter, run out and go back to the store. It should be like a
service. That was Synapse, correct?
That's what Synapse, yeah. Right. And very early in the curve, I met Jay Walker, who is certifiably brilliant. And Jay has many, many gifts. The fact is that logistics and managing people. He always wanted to manage no more than seven people.
I think they say that you're not supposed to manage more than seven people.
He only wanted seven in his company, right? So
there's something to be said for that sometimes.
There is, actually. But, you know, when you do scale, and when we got to not seven but 70, it was very clear that all this people thing was not in his sweet spot. So his job became to think of the next thing we could do together. And every day there was another next thing. And one day it was Priceline, which was, and you got to go back to the middle 90s for this to realize exactly how visionary it was. We financed the early goings of Priceline through Synapse. And even when it came like our B round, Jay sold a bunch of his shares of Synapse to General Atlantic Partners, because there was no internet industry. In fact, we didn't call it the internet. It was WWW something or other, and now...
You were really a precursor to much extent.
Jay was very much ahead of his time, and he was really kind of a thinker, an advanced thinker, and for me, Priceline was very simple. You were, you know, disintermediating the ticket broker, right? It was self-serve. I would say that this was Piggly Wiggly, right, for travel. Now, what was Piggly Wiggly? They never got credit for it, but they invented three things. They invented the aisle, right? They invented the cart.
I don't know this.
And they invented the checkout, right? And Piggly Wiggly exists to this day, but that system. So back in the John Wayne movies, when he would walk in and he'd throw open the doors and say, I want some sugar, some flour, and those, you know, stockings up there, right? And some clerk is running around and putting him in a sack. That was the model. And then Piggly Wiggly came around, transformed it, right, to self-serve. You got a cart, you went up and down the aisle, and then you would check out.
And look at what Target's done with it now. Now you don't even need a person to check out.
Right.
And you don't even need a checkout anymore.
Right.
You go into Whole Foods. But, that is, of all the stories, I've never heard you tell that story.
Yeah, that's a great, but I mean, it's an illustration of somebody who invented something very profound and didn't protect it. Right, and should have figured out how to protect it.
But even in marketing, that's sometimes all it takes is an interesting idea. It doesn't have to be spots or dots or buying a bunch of billboards or newspaper ads or even running a bunch of digital ads.
Yep.
It's an idea sometimes. Yep. Often it's an idea.
Right. Did you see the movie The Founder?
Yes.
That was a great film.
Oh, yeah.
But there's another example. I mean, hamburgers were around for a long time. Yeah. But what they did is, right?
They needed a salesperson, though.
They took like modern production methods and applied it to him.
I mean, one of your heroes. I mean, this guy was somebody who always figured out a way to take to some extent, somebody else's product and make it more consumer friendly. I mean, I had the old Nomad jukebox. That's how old I am.
Right.
And he perfected it, you know?
He did.
And then was an incredible marketer to some extent.
It really is amazing. And there's so many Jobs stories. I'll start with this.
Did you ever meet him?
I did. I actually met him multiple times, but the time that was most profound was when he was coming back from cancer, right? And he was a very frail shadow of himself, and he was very vulnerable, and it was very interesting to talk to him then because he was a little bit more introspective than I've ever seen him. But a genius of our time because here was a guy.
One of the best marketers ever.
One of the best of everything ever.
Yeah.
He is going to go down. He is the Edison times about 10 of his day, and we're going to remember him for that. I mourn the loss of Steve Jobs.
How did he let it happen? How did he let that happen?
That is a darn good question. I don't know what it is. I don't know if there's something about an entrepreneur that they think they're invincible. They think they can invent their way out of it. But you're right. Why he didn't seek medical treatment
in advance. Too many people around him to not.
Do that. Right. But I.
Tragic.
I have, one of my good friends is a guy named Nick Nicholas. Nick is in his 70s. Nick was the CEO of Time Warner for a time. And Nick and I were having lunch, and he said, Michael, even the greats, right? Even the greats, one good idea, right? And I said, Michael Dell, he goes, one good idea. I said, Bill Gates, one good idea. Ted Turner, one good idea. Steve Jobs, you got me there. Because that guy transformed the half dozen industry and everything.
But put good people around himself.
Good people around him.
As well.
And he was maniacal, and he was driven, and he was a tyrant, right? He was a tyrant. And the story I remember about him, about being a tyrant, was that he had one of the very first iPhones given to him. And he said, make it smaller. And the engineer said, I can't make it smaller. And he had a fish tank, and he threw it in the fish tank, and bubbles come up. And he said, see, you can make it smaller. Because it had air in it, right? Yeah. What an amazing, what? But you got to be a tyrant. He's got to be, he was, if you read the book, the book that was written about him,
yeah.
That's about this thick, written by a Time Inker, by the way.
I read it.
Yep. And but what you learn is that there were warts and all, and there were plenty of warts. The guy was not a nice guy, and you couldn't be a nice guy because you had to be that demanding.
Is that sad, though? Does it make you sad to realize here's this genius, right?
Yeah.
There's only a handful of them that we could name,
right.
And you've named three of them. Had all the money in the world.
Yep.
Got sick.
Yep.
At some point, something that Bonin, said to me when I asked him what's most important to you, and he said, time. Time is the most valuable thing I have. I've got more money than I know what to do with. You wouldn't know that actually if you're ever around him because he seems to he borrows space from people. I mean, he's crazy.
Well, he borrows money from me,
yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, now that I know that, I'm going to collect.
But anyway. Time, he said, that's the thing. And you look,
it's always the
you
enemy.
Look at Jobs and you think, was he happy?
Yeah, I think he was partially happy. I think he had bouts of happiness, but I think he was uncomfortable always. And I think that there was this notion that he's behind, constantly behind, that somebody else is creeping up and is going to beat him. I think that's the types of things that propel guys like that.
And how about you? Are you happy?
Yes, I am happy, but I'm never satisfied. And there's a difference. And I think there's always people smarter. There's always ideas that other people, I see an idea a day and I say, I wished I had that V8 moment. How could they do that? This is a Michael idea and somebody else had it. They stole my idea that I didn't have. Totally unfair. So I'm always on the run. I'm always thinking that, somebody's having it and I don't have it and it's crowding me. And I'm sure that I'm not the only one. I'm sure it's not only entrepreneurs, but, artists and poets and songwriters and playwrights. And
it's even harder sometimes, probably, again, for
even
VPs.
Even you, Sean.
Some days you're happy. Some days you're not. Some days you're trying to figure it out.
Right.
This space, this marketing space, it's changing so
daily
fast.
Yeah.
Marketers are pressed even more to have to know more. I mean, a VP or a chief marketing officer has to know every element that's underneath the glacier. You used to only have to know the top part. Now you need to know all of it. And that adds so much stress.
Yeah.
And it's trying to figure out, to your point, how much is enough,
I think on the stress thing, I think that it becomes very hard to make a good decision when you are stressed like that. We have an event, and it's coming up, called Internatopia. We have 40 interns. We take half, and half we place in great startups, which, by the way, are really great, with great CEOs and great teams and great missions, but they don't have the cash, right? $1 equals $1,000. So we pay for them. We pay for the interns to get these little evangelists and get these companies to love us. Shh, don't tell people my secret. Anyway, but one thing we have is we teach all the interns how to play poker. And I have one of the great poker players, like the guy who won the championship like 3 years in a row. And why? because poker teaches you a couple of profoundly important things.
Okay, one I heard you talk about this.
One is how to bluff, right? You got to learn how your cards suck, right? They're dreadful. But you got to, right? But you're there and you're in a presentation and there's a VC and you're making a pitch. Or there's a client, right? And you're faking it while you're making it. And you got to make a pitch. And if if all of a sudden your eyes and, you know, that little twitch, you know, that you, like the one you have. Anyway, the little twitch.
I play poker.
Right. Okay. If that is, you know, if that's your tell, then you're done. You're just done. So you got to learn how, right, to go in with that confidence. And the other thing is, if the chips in the middle are your life savings, and that's what you think about when you're betting, you've lost, right? So there's a detachment. There is a courageousness that you got to have. And if you're that CMO, you got to go in and you got to go in with a thesis. And when somebody leans in and says, are you sure? The answer is no, I'm never sure. That's why we test, right? But I think what you got to do is you got to be confident. You got to fail fast. I recommend, by the way, that if you're, you know, we all work, anybody who's successful, I hate to tell you the secret of success. It's 80 hours a week, right? That's what it is.
I literally feel like I average 83 hours a week.
Well, that's what that's what it takes.
And really? I can't do this at 45?
Yeah, sorry about that. No, sorry. You can't you can't do that.
Thank you for coming on the show, Mike.
I know, and screwing everything up for you. But
it takes that much work.
It just takes the work. I mean, you know, it's the 10,000 hour thing, right? I mean, you know, it's what Gladwell tells us. He didn't invent that, but it's 10,000 hours. It's Michael Jordan, after the game is over, what is he doing? He's taking shots, right, from all around the court.
That's what separates the haves from the have-nots.
You know, because it does start with talent, but it only starts with talent. And it does start with intelligence. But after that, it's like, you know, I will never give up. The persistence and the insistence. I say of CEOs that the quality that I look for the most is that guy or gal who will rip their own arm out of their own socket and beat you with it if they think it's going to help them win. Like, they will not quit. They are unbelievably persistent.
You like challenger people that are constantly.
You challenge your people. Yeah. Now, by the way, not quitting doesn't mean, because Einstein also said that if you do the same thing over and over again, if you fail over and over again the same way, that's
stupidity,
yeah. Right? So you can't do that. You got to try something new. So you try to go through it. If you can't do that, you got to go over it. And if you can't do that, you got to go around it or tunnel under it or build a new wall, but something. And it's those people, you know, that are going
to
win.
The companies that you invest in, now you invest in a lot of them. A lot of them tend to be startups to some extent.
A lot of we start up ourselves.
And so where does marketing play a role in that process?
Everything. Marketing is everything.
And so you have a group of guys and girls who are your go-tos when it comes to, look, we're launching this, and you know everything there is to know about this?
We have, think of two rings and a bullseye, and in the middle are the companies, and we have about 20 startups that we're starting up. A little over half are in New York. We've got
Are you always cycling?
We're always cycling.
Okay.
And the people engaged in those companies are always cycling. And so the thing about entrepreneurs, which is kind of interesting, is you can be an entrepreneur in your 20s. Anybody can be an entrepreneur in your 20s.
You have nothing to lose.
You got nothing to lose.
I was a 40-year-old entrepreneur.
You got something
40.
To lose. I know. That's not
I
too many of those.
Enough money to be able
that.
To say,
right.
if it doesn't work, I can go back in 2 years.
Right. You noticed he didn't say the
I did not
F
say
word.
It. I said it that way.
Wow.
Michael.
Okay. Now I know how to say it.
That's right.
Thank you for that. You're entirely right about that. That's a rarity, and you have to save enough money because VCs will tell you the odds are 2 in 10, and you can't go in your 30s, hi, honey, or 40 in your case, and you go, hi, honey, I'm signing up for 2 in 10, and you're going to hear, well, what about the mortgage? Oh, well, I'm sure it's going to work, right? You can't sign up. So you can be an entrepreneur in your 20s. To be an entrepreneur in your 30s, except for you, you needed to have a big
There
hit.
Are days I do not think I'm the exception, by the
right.
way. Believe me, there are days.
Right, but we get a lot of people in their 30s who had a small victory or were hanging around the entrepreneur's hoop who got some, so they got a taste, right? And they want more. And those are perfect folks for us because they do get a salary. I call everybody a pirate, which is I pay for room and board, but you make money on the plundering. So the first ring are all the companies. You're the only one who liked it, but I like you. That's good.
Well, that's fair enough.
The companies, so, and we got about 20.
I'm an old pirate.
A bunch are here and a bunch are around the country. A bunch of the 20, we started organically ourselves. In other words, our idea, our
idea
execution.
Came up. Yep. Right? Pull the teams together.
And what's neat is, you know, we're becoming more and more metastasized, bad word, but a lot of times it's not just, you know, the upper echelon that are figuring out the new ideas. It's like everybody is throwing ideas in the hopper and they're good and they're good. And it's kind of interesting. And we,
that's where capital helps because have capital to fail.
Capital. And then the other ring is not the companies, but what we call shared services. And shared services are, think of it as the shed of tools that every entrepreneur needs to start and build and scale, right? And what does that sound like? In addition to the capital, back office accounting, why entrepreneurs are dreadful at back office accounting. What about coding a bill has anything to do with realizing the future? Then you have legal, then you have strategy, then you have UI, UX, then we have an in-house agency for all the collateral. You have community, you have space, you have people who make sure that, yes, you know, seamless web does deliver every day because that's important. You got to keep those bellies full. Can't think with an empty stomach. So, but our stock and trade is, oh, and then we have tech, right?
Yeah.
We have tech, but we also have marketing from new school to old school. New school is exactly
the same. Do you keep that in-house or do you use
all in-house? All in-house. And when I say all in-house, pretty much all in-house. Yeah. But everything I just described is in-house. And those services are free to the companies, right? Why are they free to the companies? Because the last thing I want is some CEO storming up to some art director saying, what do you mean it took you 5 hours to make a logo? How could it be 5 hours to make a logo? Sometimes it takes 5 hours to make the perfect logo. You do it 100 times over to get the perfect logo. And it's a bad conversation. And so
Nobody ends up happy.
I don't like anybody spending time ticking a timesheet saying 2 hours in this, an hour of this. It's a big soup. The folks that run the companies have a piece of their company. The folks in shared services have a piece of the house. So points, right, go to the house. And it's this big soup. Nobody knows, you know, I'm getting X from this and Y from this, because that's not the purpose. The purpose is teamwork.
Everybody has a vested interest.
Everybody's got a vested interest. And just like in a baseball game, you can't pick out, you know, over the course of the year, little tiny performances. I mean, basically, you need the entire team to perform, or in football, better stated.
And that's where it's nice, again, to have, in essence, a full marketing suite team that's there, because you never quite know what you need.
Right.
We got a few more minutes with you.
Sure.
And so to dovetail off of that marketing piece to some extent, what advice from your perspective, having now dealt with all kinds of sized companies, from these small startups to something as huge as Priceline and Synapse to some extent, what advice do you feel like you have for today's chief marketing officer or VP of marketing? If they're not an entrepreneur, what can they take from this conversation that is actionable for them to be able to go back in tomorrow and just do their job either better or smarter or with a better resolve that that the future is is still very bright?
So the future is very bright. We've never seen, Sean, a time like this. And what do I mean by that? Capital formation has never been easier. There never has been more disruptive, and there's never been more powerful distribution channels than we have today. So those, for those people, those lunatics who think differently, this is your time, right? I would recommend to that CMO, number one, have a facile mind, right? And I'm a big believer in, you know, reading. Now, people say, Michael, do you take time off? What I do is I read, right? You got to read. You just got to read, and you got to think. And my time off is doing that. I think you have to appreciate what you're good at and what you're not good at. And I certainly, and what I've, one of the things I've learned, I've learned a couple of things, but one of the things I've learned is we're all a combination of A's and C's and F's, right? Don't spend any time on the F's, right? Get somebody else, you know, make a team and say, this is what I'm good at and this is what I'm dreadful at and this is what I'm okay at, and get the people to plug those holes, because you can spend all the time in the world on the F's. Like Roger Federer doesn't spend a whole lot of time in the kitchen, right? I mean, maybe he can learn to make a serviceable omelet, but it's why? Not, right, it's just not worth his time. I mean, he should be practicing tennis.
It's back to that time analogy to some extent. That's all you've got.
That's all you got. So take that A and turn it into a double A, and take the double A and turn it into a triple A, and then go triple A plus plus. Be the best in the world in that one thing. Right?
And that'll carry you.
And that'll carry you. And understand what you're good at. Understand what you're not good at. Build the frame a team around those skills and non-skills. And by the way, you should advertise what you're terrible at. You should say to your team, I'm not, the reason why, Sean, you're here, I'm not good at that, right? Your job is that. Don't ever tell me that I didn't hand that off to you. You need to anticipate.
I told you I wasn't good at it.
I told you I wasn't good at it. And you need, and that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for somebody. So I am.
That comes back to solve, don't sell to some extent, not to cut you midpoint.
It's okay.
But that's, as an executive, you're asking somebody to help you solve a problem. Don't sell me something else. If I'm asking you to solve a problem, it's because it's something I'm either not good at or I'm trying to get you to help me with it.
Right.
And so maybe again, that kind of brings that full circle to some extent.
So I think that CMO should appreciate what they're good at and not good at, and not be at all embarrassed about what they're not good at. Just make sure that you got something, you know, some compensating, countervailing effect in your team that's going to help you with that. And the other recommendation I would have, and this was a Jay Walkerism, he didn't invent it, but he would say it a lot.
Okay.
A people hire A people, and B people hire C people, right? Mm-hmm. And A people hire A people because they know they got an A game, and they don't care. Like, if they hire somebody better than them, hallelujah, right? It's just going to push me to the next thing. And if that person is so good, I got to find another job. Well, double hallelujah.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just have an open lane somewhere else. B people hire C people because B people are concerned about job security. So they make sure they hire somebody weaker because then it becomes a reinforcing error. So anyway.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Last question. This is it. How was this for you, by the way?
This was, you know, except for that thing you made me sit on.
Yes, your anyway, phone.
Right.
I had to
my
put
whoopee
my way
cushion.
Too.
Anyway.
Thank you for saying yes.
You know, you must hate your audience. Done. This was torture.
I thought you had some great points. This is my last question.
Okay.
You have 6 kids. Mm. And you once said that this could be this, I believe the secret to your legacy would be to prove Keats wrong, another writer.
Yep.
Your daughter works with you now.
Right.
So how is it to know that as, you know, as all of this is happening, you've now passed this down to another generation.
So Keats, just to be clear, on his gravestone, right, ironically, he has, our names are writ on water, which is a big F you, right, because his name is written granite, right? The rest of us, we're written water. What I want, you know, is I'm jealous of Jobs. I'm jealous of all those guys who built a legacy. And what was his legacy? His legacy was that of invention. He has built some incredibly enduring things. And so have all the other greats. So if I could be at least a footnote to that part of history, I will be in my grave a happy guy, because I want to prove that I am not that ephemeral, that I built something that was enduring, that was important, that changed lives for the better. And that's my goal.
Well, I've only met one of your children, and the daughter of yours that I've met, she seems to have
apple of my eye
garnered all of your better traits. Right. Listen, that's it. This is our last episode of season 3. Michael Loeb, thank you so incredibly much for your time. If you want to find out more about Michael, literally all you got to do is Google out there. He is very giving of his time in many cases. There's a lot of amazing content out there. He speaks at a lot of big industry trade events. Everything that I got to see was all incredibly insightful. So thank you for helping us round out the season with an hour of your time and with some great insights that for us, I'm sure will carry on for more than just that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Take us out of the show.
Thanks for hanging out in the CMO suite. For marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
Don't miss The Digital Fix, the podcast for digital marketing done right, this summer on iTunes and Spotify.
You're a C-level manager. You shouldn't have to know the difference between behavioral or contextual targeting, but your agency should. Uconnects provides brands and biddable teams direct access to platforms like The Trade Desk, Google, Amazon, Facebook, OTT, and more. Their U.S.-based traders can train your in-house team or provide complete transparency with no minimums and CPM-based service pricing for true transparency. Something Mighty Hive, The Trade Desk, and Centro simply don't offer. Tired of being the smartest one in the room? Reach out to Uconnects today for a free demo. Uconnects. the world's leader in true, transparent, biddable media.